You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The old adage, there are two types of people in the world, applies to today's program, as the subject is maps. And for people who love maps, and I'm one of them, these documents are far more than a device to get from point A to point B. Maps stir our imagination. They tell stories of history, of topography, science, travel, exploration, and even the unknown. Well, my guest today shares his own love of maps in telling a story about an antiquarian map dealer turned thief. A thief who stole maps worth millions of dollars from some of the world's most prestigious libraries and museums. Till he was caught one day leaving Yale's library with an X-Acto knife and a rare copy of Captain John Smith's map of the American coastline. Michael Blanding is a journalist and senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University and tells the story of E. Forbes Smiley III, a map dealer and thief who admitted to stealing over 90 rare maps, ranging from Cortez's 1524 map of the Gulf of Mexico to early 19th century maps of the U.S. and American states. The name of the book is The Map Thief. It's published by Gotham Books. And in it, he tells the story of Smiley as well as a short history of the history of map making. It's a fascinating book. Michael Blanding is my guest today. Michael Blanding, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
This is a very interesting story. I mean, the idea that a respected dealer in antiquities and especially in maps would be caught leaving a Yale library with an X-Acto knife and a cutout map in his pocket. But even the bigger story in The Map Thief is the whole story of the love of maps and the history of mapping, which you tell in the course of the book. And it sounds like you are a map person. For those who are not map people, and I know a lot of people who are not map people, what is the attraction of a map, whether it's a Rand McNally or a 19th century exploration map?
Well, first of all, I have to say, you know, I've always been a map person. I've loved maps since I was a kid. I could just stare at them for hours and take, you know, imaginary trips tracing the lines on them. But I've been surprised working on this book about how many other secret map lovers there are out there, you know, going to the proverbial cocktail party or dinner party and talking with people. I'm amazed by how many people say, you know, oh, I love maps. And, you know, for some people, it's the artistry of them. It's the beauty of some of these old maps. For some people, it's, you know, the science behind how they're constructed. Other people, it's the excitement of exploration and of discovering other territories and other places. And, you know, they work on a number of levels, and I think especially in this day and age when we're all you know, attached to our GPS, there's something about the allure of that paper map that really draws people in.
Also the history too, because we have a global map on our wall in our studios here, and you know exactly when it was made because it was made in 1938. And the reason you know it's 1938 was because of the political boundaries of that particular year.
Yeah, it's really amazing. That was one of the things that I discovered working on this book, is just how maps tell stories. And depending on who drew the map and what country they were from and what their agenda was, you know, different maps drawn at the exact same time could have different boundaries drawn or different territories emphasized in order to kind of further the political agenda of the map makers. And so there's a real history there. There's a real kind of storytelling quality that, of course, is one of the reasons that makes these maps so valuable and so prized by collectors.
My guest today is Michael Blanding. His new book is titled The Map Thief, the gripping story of an esteemed rare map dealer who made millions stealing priceless maps. It's published by Gotham Books. And he tells the story in the book, not only the history of map making, but the story of E. Forbes Smiley. Now tell us a little about E. Forbes Smiley.
E. Forbes Smiley III, it just sort of has that irresistible name that you know, right from the beginning kind of draws you in. But to friends, he was known as Forbes Smiley, and he was a legitimate map dealer for about 20 years and really dealt in the high end of the map trade. So we're talking maps from, you know, the 16th century, 17th century, about the exploration of America, and some of these maps are worth thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars, even upwards of $100,000 to collectors. And so he made a living at this for a number of years and became successful and made quite a bit of money. And then at a certain point, he ended up just not being able to compete in this really kind of dog-eat-dog world of map dealers and map collectors. And one day, we're not quite sure when, he turned to theft and he walked out of a rare book library with a map in hand and kind of went down the slippery slope and became a map thief rather than a map dealer. And that transition, that fall from grace, if you will, was just really fascinating to me to try to understand how somebody who loved these rare artifacts could go in and defile and deface them and deprive libraries of the very maps that he cherished.
One thing I found astonishing as I was reading about the way map dealers do business is they might spend $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 for an atlas. Now, this might be an atlas from the 19th century, maybe even the 18th or 17th century. And you tell the story of some map dealers, they're picking up the book at the auction house, and they're tearing the binding out, and they're tearing the book up, which just strikes me as crazy. And the fact that each map individually is probably worth more than the atlas together.
Yeah, that was something that surprised me too, and a lot of people find shocking. You know, I think back when map collecting first started back in, say, the 1950s, you know, there weren't a lot of people that were collecting maps. They weren't worth a huge amount of money, and so some of these old map collectors, these map dealers said, you know, well, why not? We'll rip these atlases apart that people aren't buying anyway, and we'll sell these individual maps and make a lot more money at it. And as the years have gone on now, a lot of these atlases have become more and more rare because there are more map collectors out there, and there's only a limited number of these materials. And so it's gotten to the point where now the atlas itself is much more valuable because it's so hard to find because so many of them have been torn apart over the years. But there's some map dealers are still doing that, still breaking up these atlases. And it seems shocking to treat a piece of history that way. But, you know, there's a lot of there's big money in this field, and it makes sense to people.
Now, we think that Smiley may have stole more than 97 maps. He admitted to stealing 97 of them. And these are from some of the finest research libraries in the world: Harvard, Yale, the New York Public Library, the Boston Public Library, the British Library, and the Newberry Library in Chicago. So how did he go in there and do it?
It was surprisingly easy, to be honest. You know, he would go into some of these map rooms, and they had security where they would make you check your belongings at the door. But he could go in, and sometimes he would bring other books and papers with him so that people didn't know what he brought in and what he was taking out. And he would just kind of wait for an opportune moment when the librarian had his or her back turned, or he would find a convenient pillar that would block their view, and then he would just rip these maps out. And there's a security camera footage that I was able to view from the Yale Library from the day he was caught, and he was, almost like a magician, the way that he was able to just kind of really quickly fold these maps and pull them out of the bindings of the book and then stuff them in his blazer pocket. You know, I had to rewind the tape 5 times to even see it happen. So he was very skilled. He was he definitely knew what he was looking for and knew what he was doing. And it was shockingly easy to walk out of these libraries with, tens of thousands of dollars in his pocket of rare maps.
And what was also interesting to me was that the libraries, while they would catalog a atlas, they wouldn't catalog the individual maps within them. And the way map dealers work, it's, a good map is worth as much as the book. I mean, the book is probably worth more, but even a good map is worth a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people ask me, how did he get away with it? Did he have to sell these on the black market, or did he have to somehow obscure their origins? And the truth is that it's not like a work of art where you have, one painting hanging in a museum that everybody knows where it is. These maps may have been printed in, 1,000 of them 400 years ago, and maybe a dozen remain today. And the cataloging at these libraries is such that a lot of times the libraries didn't know whether a book was containing a map or not. So he could go in and take a map out of one of these books, and the library wouldn't know it was missing, and then he could turn around and sell it to a collector or a dealer that he'd been doing business with for years and tell them that he was selling off, you know, an old collection from a former client, and they'd be none the wiser. So it was really just the nature of the map trade that he was able to get away with this very easily. He really had no fear of being caught until that fateful day that he dropped the X-Acto knife blade on the floor.
You actually open the book pretty much with the story of him getting pinched, and it starts with him dropping an X-Acto knife on the floor. He's in the Yale, one of the Yale libraries, and he doesn't realize he's dropped it. So a librarian picks up the X-Acto, and I'm assuming internal alarm bells were going off.
Exactly. And the irony of that day was that he wasn't even using the blade to cut maps out that day, although he'd used a blade on other occasions. He actually had it folded up in his back pocket in a handkerchief, and he had a cold that day and pulled the handkerchief out to blow his nose, and the blade fell out without him noticing. And you know, as you mentioned, the librarian found it, and security guard ended up following him, or Yale police officer ended up following him out of the library and stopped him. And sure enough, he had a map in his blazer pocket, and that sort of started this whole thing unraveling.
But he almost got away with it even then, because the librarians had no idea if he had taken anything or not, and they knew he was a map dealer and that he probably owned some of the maps that he had on his person.
Right, absolutely. If it hadn't been for that security tape footage, and it hadn't been for one map in particular that had a very distinctive handwriting from one of the Yale map, someone who had donated maps to Yale years before, had written on some of the maps and had a very distinctive handwriting. And so that helped them identify one map. And then another map they actually identified because it had wormholes in the map that matched up with the wormholes in the book from which it was taken. And that's sort of the most incredible forensic evidence that I've ever heard of.
Wow. I think in the book you talk about one of them being a map by John Smith, who went over with the Jamestown colony, helped them get through the first couple of years. The colonists really did not like him, got rid of him, and he went back to England and basically made maps, told how he helped the Virginians survive and how they were ungrateful, tried to figure out ways to get to the New World, but because he couldn't get back to the New World and make some money, he basically made maps of the coastline, and this is one of those maps of the coastline.
Yeah, it was really incredible to learn the history of some of these map makers and explorers, which are every bit as fascinating as the map thief that I profile. And John Smith was one that I had no idea about this sort of second chapter in his life. But he, as you say, you know, we know about the Pocahontas story in Virginia, and we sort of hold him up as a hero. But he was actually never really appreciated, shall we say, for his gifts as a colonist and governor of Virginia. He was sort of this middle-class yeoman farmer, and the gentleman who ran the colony really didn't appreciate him and kicked him out. And he ended up going to New England and made the first map of New England. He actually created the name New England, and that map was one that really kind of cemented English control over that area of the country, and was actually carried by the Pilgrims on their way and helped them found the town of Plymouth. So it was really really surprising to me to learn kind of the backstories of some of these map makers that I never heard of before.
That's the other part of this book that is really interesting, because you tell the story of Smiley, but you also sort of give us a short history of the history of maps. And you would think maps go back as far as antiquity, but in fact, really, maps only started really happening about 2,000 years ago, or maybe a little more than 2,000 years ago with the Greeks and the Romans, and really not really that much on the Romans, but the Greeks made maps. And then Alexandria, the library at Alexandria, collected a lot of maps.
Yeah, it was that was really interesting to me as well, that kind of looking the way that maps have developed over the years. And we actually don't have very many maps from before, say, the Middle Ages. You know, they just didn't survive, or they weren't really used in the same way, that the kind of science just wasn't there for them to really understand the way that the world was constructed. And so maps back then were more kind of, in the Middle Ages, for example, were more kind of religious diagrams than actual place, you know, things that they could use to get from point A to point B. And it was really around the 1300s that map making started taking off and coincided with the age of exploration and Columbus and all of that, and this rush from these different countries to colonize the rest of the world, that map suddenly took off and became printed and developed in a very short time of basically a couple hundred years. Map making, the modern science of map making, really developed. And it's fascinating to kind of see that history and see how it ran in parallel with things like the printing press and the age of exploration, which we know probably much more than the history of cartography.
The name of the book is The Map Thief. My guest today is Michael Blanding, a journalist and senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you actually did meet E. Forbes Smiley, and of course, the one thing you said that immediately everybody who knew him, and once you got to know him, you understood about him, he's a highly gregarious guy, this incredible laugh, an incredibly knowledgeable person. I mean, this is not a bumbler. He really knew his craft and probably knew it as well or better than most of his competitors.
Yeah, he was a really fascinating character, and I think that's what really drew me in when I started researching the book, was just this kind of massive contradictions of this character who you kind of picture a rare map dealer being, you know, very bookish and you know, wearing the spectacles and the tweed jacket. And he was all that, but he was also an incredibly charismatic individual and had this incredible laugh and just this real kind of exuberance and this love for life that a lot of people really found charming and really drew them to him. And he could also be incredibly generous. You know, one of the ironies of the story is that when he started stealing all these maps, a lot of the money actually went to this kind of grandiose pet project he had of restoring this small town up in Maine, where he bought the general store and the post office and a restaurant and was pouring all this money into this town and employing half of the townspeople, all using this stolen money that he had gotten from stealing these maps. So it was just this really kind of strange contradiction in his character that really made me want to explore it more and really try to understand why he did what he did.
And you found that was sort of an obsession of his. He, even as early as college, he talked about building a small town. And one of the things he did during college was he built this amazing dollhouse, complete with furniture. It was like a Victorian, authentic 19th century little small pieces. So it was authentically designed, authentically, the contents were authentic to the age. And it was in a department store window for years.
Yeah, that was the thing. When I spoke with his friends from college and high school, I can't tell you how many people mentioned that. And they said, you know, you got to find out about this dollhouse. You got to track down this dollhouse. And it was really, in some ways, the whole story of his life was contained in this crazy dollhouse that he created in college that was, 4 feet high and so intricately constructed. And it just showed his love of history and also, you know, how good he was with his hands, and also his just incredible obsessiveness and just desire to create something and to be the best at something. And all of those elements are contained in Future Story, and in some ways, tragically, the way that they developed, and sort of, you know, all these kind of amazing qualities that he had ended up being used for these nefarious purposes, and ultimately proved to be his undoing. So it's just sort of fascinating to see the roots of it laid so early on in his life.
Now, one of the things the book does is it talks about, you know, he was very well regarded in his field among most people, but there were some that didn't. And I'm wondering if, you know, after he got caught, obviously, you know, people color their judgment of him. But you tell several stories that even early on, he was pretty sharp in his business practices, but it wasn't sharp in a sharp way. It was sharp in a sort of bumbling, clumsy way. He was not great with money. He would buy a map, buy it from a person, take possession of the map, write a check, it would bounce. People would have trouble getting the money from him. Eventually they would get it. But he was about trying to do this sort of turnaround. I'm going to buy it from you for X, and I'm going to sell it for X times Y. And that didn't work out an awful lot.
Yeah, I think he had this sort of Pollyannish quality to him, this sort of idealism that, you know, he wanted to be the best in the field. He wanted to deal in the best and most expensive maps that he could. And I think he just got ahead of himself. He just always kind of assumed that things would work out. And he was never a good business person. He never kind of took the time to really develop the business in a way that was sustainable. And so then in the 1990s, when map collecting took off and suddenly became popular for a lot of people, and more dealers started entering the field and really started competing against each other at these auctions. And he was just really caught flat-footed by it, and I think kept kind of holding to this idealized image of himself that, you know, he was this jet-setting dealer, you know, with this kind of New England pedigree, and that people would just kind of naturally keep buying from him and keep somehow things would work out. And there were other people that didn't really respect that and were really out to make money any way they could, as well they should, and he just couldn't compete against it, and the only option left to him was theft.
Well, it was really interesting. Of those 90-odd maps that he admitted stealing, I mean, these go from, I mean, really famous names in world history, like Cortez's maps of Mexico, mm-hmm. to maps of by Samuel Champlain of, you know, Quebec and Canada, and his trips up the St. Lawrence, to early colonial maps, to early United States maps, like state maps from, you know, like around 1800. How many of these were recovered?
So it's still an open question. He did cooperate with the FBI pretty quickly after he was arrested, and he helped them identify and recover 97 maps. We helped them identify 97 maps, and of those, most of them were recovered. Not all, but most of them were recovered. However, I was able to find about a dozen more maps that were recovered that he didn't admit to. And the libraries accuse him of taking over 100 more. And I don't think in all cases the libraries have the evidence to back it up, but in some cases they do. And so sort of an open question about how much he cooperated how many of the maps that he stole were actually returned. And I don't think we'll ever know the answer to that.
Now, he stole, by his own admission, he probably stole something, what, about $2 million worth of maps?
Yeah, probably over $3 million worth was what those 97 maps were valued at.
And he got how much time?
So he only got 3 years in prison, which surprises a lot of people, given the value of what he stole. You know, you think if you stole $3 million from a bank, 3 years would be a pretty light sentence.
That's right. If you stole $10,000 from a bank, 3 years right. would be a light sentence.
Yeah, I know. That's exactly the point that the state judge in his trial made, the federal judge and the state judge. And the state judge said, you know, I've got kids robbing convenience stores to get more time than you're getting. And the reason that, somewhat controversial reason that he got the sentence that he did is because he did cooperate with the FBI, and he did help return most of the maps that he admitted stealing. And so because of that, they wanted to set a precedent and give him credit for that and make sure that, you know, if this ever happens again, that that precedent is set so that they'll get that cooperation in the future.
Now, how's this changed the whole map collecting business? Because, you know, you think of stolen art, you know, now you have Interpol, so well-known works that are stolen, it's really hard to sell them. It's much more difficult unless you just have a buyer that's going to hoard it. You look at things like forgeries. Those forgeries, yeah, they're still forgeries, but the whole industry is basically try to catalog everything so they know whether this is something that really was a work of the artist or a forgery. Has anything changed in this whole subgenre of map collecting and antiquarian books and the like? I would think this has changed a lot of things.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the irony is that this is not the first time that this has happened. There was another map thief, not quite on the scale of Barb Smiley, but stole a number of maps from libraries 10 years before Smiley did. And, you know, there were a lot of calls to increase security and to increase cataloging back then. And yet Bart Smiley was able to get away with what he did. So I think a lot of the libraries have done a lot to their credit to increase security. They've taken digital images of maps. They've improved their cataloging, installed cameras, things like that. But there's still a lot of secrecy that is just endemic to the map trade, with dealers not wanting other dealers to know what they have and who they're selling it to. And so there's a real incentive against disclosure when items do go missing from libraries or when dealers are selling maps, if they have several copies of a particular map that's out there that's very rare, that might tip people off to the fact that maps are being stolen. So in some ways, yes, I think that things have improved. And in some ways, I think this is just endemic to this trade. And I really wouldn't be surprised if we were to hear about another map thief in the future.
Now, one of the things you do in the book, as I mentioned, was that you tell sort of a brief history of map making and of great map makers and why these maps are important. What did you learn along the way of learning that history that, as a map lover yourself, really you fell in love with maybe a map maker or a particular set of maps? Was there anything that you fell in love with along the way?
Yeah, there were so many map makers that I really came intrigued by, and it was really interesting to see their stories and kind of how they paralleled Smiley's own story. There was this one map maker named John Steller who was kind of single-handedly created the first atlas of English maps, and that book was used by mariners in the 1700s to really establish England's dominance over the world. And yet, he got very little credit for it. He was a bad businessman, just like Smiley was, and he died poor. And there was another map maker named Robert Dudley, who was the illegitimate son of a English lord who was rumored to be Queen Elizabeth's lover, and he ended up being exiled in Italy and created this really incredible atlas of all the coastlines in the world and used the Mercator projection for an atlas for the first time. You know, just the characters involved in these stories and their ambition and their competition against other map makers really intrigued me and really formed this interesting parallel that shows you that, you know, a lot hasn't changed in the map trade in the past 300 years.
You know, certainly the world is pretty well mapped these days. Do you think this is a sort of a dying field in any way? Because, you know, so much of our world is now on our GPS or on our smartphones. There are people who love maps and there are people who don't love maps. I'm wondering if that love of map making is and reading maps is going away. Do you think?
I think quite the opposite. I think that because of GPS and Google Maps and all of that, I think that there's this sort of nostalgia for paper maps.
Well, it's an interesting book, The Map Thief. Michael, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Journalist Michael Blanding is a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University and the author of The Map Thief, the gripping story of an esteemed rare map dealer who made millions stealing priceless maps. It's published by Gotham Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent episodes, you can listen online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org or search through our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.